This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. My co-host Anthony Brooks is off today. Well, it might be the end of the working week for some of us, but things are just beginning for the five hopefuls in the Massachusetts Senate special election.
Me llamo Gabriel Gomez, y no soy un político.
I'm going to take more experience over to the United States Senate than any other congressman in the history of our country.
I am pro-life. I'm fiscally conservative.
I'll care about Massachusetts and America first.
I actually think we have to shake things up a little bit in the U.S. Senate. That's what I'm going there to do.
Shake things up in Congress. There's an idea, given the total impasse over sequestration.
We shouldn't be making a series of dumb, arbitrary cuts to things that businesses depend on.
And the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, John Roberts, calls Massachusetts' minority voting record into question. Massachusetts Secretary of State Bill Galvin cries foul.
To try to take advantage of a clearly erroneous data is wrong, it's deceptive, and it's a slur on black voters in Massachusetts.
And City Councilor John Connolly says he wants to be Boston's next mayor. His assessment of current mayor Tom Menino?
Look, I give him an A for effort, but the grade, ultimately the one that counts, is a failing grade.
So, sequestration, the Supreme Court, the Senate, and mayoral races, much to discuss in our Week in Review. And here to do so is Renee Loth, editor of Architecture Boston and columnist for the Boston Globe. Great to see you again, Renee.
Thank you.
Also with us is Peter Kadzis, editor of The Phoenix. Peter, welcome to Radio Boston.
Great to be here.
It's terrific to have you. So let's start with non-news news, and that is the impasse over sequestration, because today President Obama met with several congressional leaders at the White House. They came out of that meeting with no agreement, meaning sequestration is going to go forward. Here is President Obama expressing his frustration at that fact a little earlier today.
At a time when our businesses have finally begun to get some traction, hiring new workers, bringing jobs back to America, we shouldn't be making a series of dumb, arbitrary cuts to things that businesses depend on and workers depend on, like education and research and infrastructure and defense. It's unnecessary, and at a time when too many Americans are still looking for work, it's inexcusable.
Renee, let's start with you. It's actually kind of surprising to hear the President of the United States use the word dumb. I mean, it's as frustrated as I've heard him in recent days and weeks. So what's your response to the fact that predictably no agreement was reached today?
Yeah, I think he's right to be frustrated. I mean, he's done everything short of what he called a Jedi mind meld in order to be able to get the Congress to step up to its responsibilities here. And, you know, this is the kind of situation where the impact of the cuts are not going to be felt immediately, and they're not going to be felt by everyone. And so there's a lot of, you know, grousing that this is, you know, crying wolf, or that this really kind of just a lot of posturing. But to those people for whom they rely on government checks, you know, whether they're military people or folks who work in the national parks, it's really going to be a very bad thing. It's going to really affect them deeply.
Yeah. I mean, we're looking at an $85 billion across the board cut. And I take your point about the president's frustration. But on the other hand, Peter, President Obama did sign the Budget Control Act that helped get us here.
Well, the thing with sequestration is that it was a compromise that was supposed to be amended. Well, no one has amended it. I think for the average person, there are two things worth taking away from this. One, this isn't as important as the consideration on March 27th, when the funding for the entire rest of the year is up for grabs. Now, something good could happen in that the sequestration could be mitigated in a sensible way, or something bad could happen, and we could go off another cliff if agreement isn't made. I'm voting for bad, by the way. The other thing is, here in Massachusetts, the effect is going to be much more aimed at the middle class than most people realize. Massachusetts is extremely dependent on medical research at the universities and defense spending, and that means a lot of middle class families are going to be hit.
Interesting. Well, we'll keep our eye on this and hope for the best for everyone. But let's talk about a place in politics where there is a lot of action going on, and that's in the race for the U.S. Senate and who might fill John Kerry's former seat in the special election that's coming up. This week, five potential candidates met the deadline to submit 10,000 signatures needed to officially enter the race, including a new face, perhaps, to Massachusetts politics, private equity investor and former Navy SEAL Gabriel Gomez. Here, he's gaining momentum in Massachusetts amongst Republicans. And here's former Lieutenant Governor Kerry Healy talking about that.
He's the new Republican that we are hoping to attract in our party. He hasn't been a politician before, but he's served his country his whole life. I think that's the kind of person who we really need. And Gabriel comes from a family that has experienced the American dream, and he's really realized their dreams. And so I think that that's a message that's going to be very strong for our party.
Renee, interesting. He's a really interesting candidate, I think. So tell me more about what you think about, let's start with Gabriel Gomez and talk about him.
Yeah, well, you know, he has going for him, unfortunately, in a way, because, you know, politics have become so cynical. What he has going for him is that he's not a politician. He's never served in office. He has been a Navy SEAL, and, you know, he represents a demographic that the Republicans very much want to attract. He's liberal-ish on the social issues in that kind of winning formula for Massachusetts Republicans. And he's quite conservative on fiscal issues. And if you listen to his, announcement speech, he really parroted the Republican Party line on the, you know, fiscal crisis that we're having in Washington, just saying that, you know, revenues are off the table and he doesn't want to have any kind of balanced approach and it's got to be all cut, cut, cut. So, I mean, I think in that regard, he may be a little bit outside of the Massachusetts electorate's mainstream.
Mm. Peter, do you agree?
Yeah, although he does, he's definitely the new kid in the block, the new face. However, he does have the sort of backroom shadow support of the Romney organization, the Brown people, the Kerry Healy, North Shore money crowd. The all-time favorite, the red meat Republican, is Sullivan, who has the Plymouth and Cape group. He also has the Tea Party people. He walks, talks, sounds like a Republican, albeit the sort of standard model. But there's something interesting about him, not in the primary, but he's the front runner, I think.
Sullivan.
Yeah, Sullivan. He served 3 years during the Bush administration as head of the ATF, Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. And during that time, the Fast and Furious scandal. Mm-hmm. Now, if Sullivan is the guy that makes it to the final run, the Democrats are going to have a lot of ammunition to shoot at him, if you will. Very bad pun. That was unintentional. Winslow's sort of the odd man out. I mean, he has the support of younger Republicans, but he doesn't have a foot with the money crowd or with the old sort of more stolid people.
Well, let's name all the candidates a little more clearly for people who don't remember. So as you just said, there's Representative Dan Winslow, Michael Sullivan, former U.S. attorney and former head of, as you mentioned, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and Gabriel Gomez, as we also just spoke about. On the Democratic side, of course, there's Representatives Ed Markey and Stephen Lynch as well. So Renee Loth, a couple of months ago, people were saying, well, there wasn't going to be much of a race, but this actually looks like you could have, after the primaries, an interesting battle.
Well, I think, also the primaries will be very interesting. And, you know, as with all Massachusetts primaries, the big imponderable here is the unenrolled voter who can take a Democratic ballot or a Republican ballot in the primaries.
And it seems they might find interesting candidates on either
side. Exactly. Often the independents sort of default go to the Democratic primary because that's where all the action is, but this year there's going to be a lot of action also on the Republican side. And for example, as Peter points out, Mr. Sullivan, who is the only really true social conservative among the five candidates, could conceivably pull some support away from Steve Lynch, kind of what I call the Ray Flynn wing of the Democratic Party, you know, the sort of social conservative, Reagan Democrats, so-called, really could be attracted to Sullivan, and that would be very bad for Lynch.
Mm. Now, what do you make of the potential attention, if any, that this race might draw nationally? I mean, obviously, when Senator Elizabeth Warren was running, there was a lot of attention there. This is just a special election, so whoever wins the seat's going to have to fight for it again in, you know, a year and in a couple of years' time. But nevertheless, it seems like every Senate seat in the U.S. Senate is of a high-value seat. So, Peter, do you think that people around the country could be looking and saying, well, you know, if we say the GOP is looking and saying if we want to get a moderate Republican in there, maybe this is the way to do it through Massachusetts?
Well, I'll tell you, just from watching the cable news shows all of them, of all ideological stripes. Not a night goes by that there's not a mention of something happening in Massachusetts. Things are so tight in the Senate that Massachusetts is once again sort of front and center in national politics. You know, I think the Democratic race, as Renee said, is going to be more exciting than people may think. Just today, as a matter of fact, as we speak, the AFL-CIO is meeting, and by 4 or 5 today, they will decide to do one of three things, either, you know, endorse one or the other of the two Democratic candidates, or decide to sit on the side.
Do you think that's possible, that they decide to sit on the side?
I think it is. I think... I think they could sit on the side. The only thing that would be a surprise is I think if they went for Markey. Mm-hmm. If they go for Markey, I'd say the race is not over, but almost over.
Yeah. A group of the AFL-CIO, the police union, has endorsed Lynch. So that, you know, the sort of expectation would be correct that Lynch would get the union support. And if he doesn't, then that's a bad sign for him.
Mm. Well, one more question about this before we move on. I mean, the compressed timeline of these special elections, these special races, is always something that I find very fascinating. Mm. And if, you know, groups like the AFL, CIO, for example, are really, really important in terms of a ground game statewide, especially
yes.
if you don't really have name recognition. Now, so, I mean, how much do you think that matters for candidates, you know, on either side of the aisle, Peter?
Well, name recognition's a problem for all five of them. So this is a time when I think union support has a disproportionate potential effect on the game. Just as the Republicans can traditionally count on a disproportionate amount of money coming their way, what comes with a union are people to make phone calls, to knock on doors, to get out the vote. So it's going to be very important.
At least on the Democratic side, I know that the two candidates have agreed to, I think, six debates.
Six, yes.
So, you know, in a compressed time period, as you say. So we're going to have, you know, debates every time you sneeze. And that's going to be, I think, you know, a really well you know, fiercely fought, and in the end could help whoever the Democratic nominee is, because it will raise the name recognition and the visibility of those candidates.
Right. And on the Republican side, I wonder, you know, if groups like, for example, Karl Rove's PAC that's trying to get more moderate Republicans into office, if they might decide to pay attention, more like financial attention to Massachusetts. So we'll have to see how that goes. Let's move on to Boston politics for just a few minutes, at least, because City Councilor John Connolly has announced that he'll be running to possibly unseat Mayor Tom Menino. And what does Mayor Menino have to say about that?
Now, a young man wants to be mayor. Good luck to him.
Good luck to him, says the mayor. Well, in terms of what Connolly has to say to Mayor Tom Menino and his performance, especially regarding education in the city of Boston, here's what John Connolly says.
Look, I give him an A for effort, but the grade, ultimately the one that counts, is a failing grade.
A failing grade. So City Councilor John Connolly not afraid to speak quite forthrightly regarding Menino. So, Peter, let's start with you. What do you make of John Connolly and his chances, if the mayor of makes it official, that he may run again?
Well, I think Connolly has an uphill battle. His edge isn't as apparent now as I think it might be during the campaign. Listen, Menino can govern quite well without moving around. But can he campaign without moving around as much? And unfortunately for the mayor, that is a real issue. However, that's where having met almost 80% of the voters of Boston one-on-one will come for him. I mean, this, I think, will come down to a youth versus age election.
That's an amazing figure that he's met 80% of the voters one-on-one.
Yeah.
Renee, your thoughts?
Well, you know, Connolly, he's likable, he's smart, he's got, you know, something of a base in his district, but, you know, he's kind of a single-issue candidate right now. I mean, it's an important issue, education. It is an area where Menino could be seen as vulnerable. You know, he said when he ran the first time, I think it was in his very first State of the City address, he said, judge me on the quality of the schools, and they haven't improved as much as they should. So he's got a real in there. But, you know, there are a lot of issues facing the city, and Connolly is going to need to be heard on many other issues, and we just don't know where he stands on those at this point.
At what point in time do you think, I mean, I'm asking you to prognosticate, so I know that there may not be a good answer to this, but the current mayor, Menino, has to say whether he's going to run or not. And I talked to him a couple weeks ago after the State of the City address, and I asked him pretty bluntly about it, and he said it's a tough answer for him to know about at this point in time, and I took him on his word. I'm not sure he 100% knows. I mean, Renee, your thoughts?
I think that's right. I mean, I think the only person who really could tell him not to run is, his wife, Angela. You know, I think that the people around him, he doesn't really listen. You know, he listens to his own heart and to his close family. But he doesn't have to say until May, you know, so he doesn't, yeah. He has to say until he doesn't have to say, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, or I have that backwards. In any case, he has some time yet. And, if he doesn't run, certainly Connolly is in a terrific position of being the instant front runner there.
Right. First out of the gate, so to speak. Peter?
No, I agree with Renee 100%. Angela Menino, the mayor's wife, she is the key to this whole equation. Listen, anyone who's known a person who's, you know, been in the process of rehabilitation knows that it comes in stages. He may be up to it. He might not. But I think more than the mayor himself, I think his wife is going to make the call.
Oh, we have to keep our ears close to the ground on that. The true power behind the throne, as they say. Well, let's move just for a couple minutes back to Washington and the Supreme Court of the United States of America, because this week, upon hearing oral arguments regarding a case that has to do with the Voter Rights Act, Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts actually pointed to Massachusetts as potentially having one of the worst or more terrible, if I can say that, records regarding minority voting in Massachusetts. The Secretary of State Bill Galvin here in the Commonwealth said, no, you've got that all wrong. We're better, much better than you think, and you're comparing apples to oranges. It's quite legalistically complicated. But Renee, I wonder what you make of John Roberts dragging Massachusetts into a voting rights case.
Yeah, well, you know, as we learn in journalism, you have to be really careful when you use absolutes. And, you know, Roberts said from the bench, you know, that Massachusetts had the worst record in voter turnout. It was the greatest disparity among other states vis-a-vis black voters and white voters. And so you have to be careful when you use those absolutes. And you also have to be careful when you take on Bill Galvin when it comes to matters of election law. I mean, the man knows more about Massachusetts election law and turnout and all of that, you know, in his pinky, yeah, than any man, you know, on the planet, basically. So he's a really formidable opponent in that regard. And, you know, I think that it is a complicated legal issue, and it does seem that, you know, we don't really know what Justice Roberts meant, and he's not, elaborating on his statements. He says, you know, what I said, or his people say, what I said in the record is going to have to stand.
Right.
So we can't really parse what he was using for his backup. But if it is the U.S. Census data, it looks like there's some flaws in that, and, you know, I think he stuck his neck out on this one.
It gives me a sense, though, that he was basically trying to, again, who can read the mind of a Supreme Court justice, but he was trying to possibly making the argument that even in states where Voting Rights Act with the federal government hasn't had to intercede, that there are problems. I mean, Peter, in that case, if that's the case, I mean, what do you make of what Chief Justice Roberts might be telegraphing in terms of how the court's looking at this case?
Well, I think his comments, the question is, were his comments reflective of a deeper frame of mind? We shouldn't forget that in 1981, Roberts was a junior lawyer, but a mid-level lawyer in the White House and in the Justice Department, and he was in charge of the Reagan administration's attack on the Voting Rights Act. At that time, in 81, in the briefs he wrote for his client, he said that, you know, the act was intrusive and unconscionable. Now, were those just lawyer's words, or is that something that he intellectually really believes? In Roberts' mind, judging from these 1981 legal papers, you have to decide, is the discrimination intentional against a single person, or is it unintended? In the Reagan administration tended to look at individual cases rather than a class case. That's the $64,000 question.
So we'll have to see how it goes when they give us more of a sense as to how they're going to decide. And I think that's waiting upon their actual decision for some time. Well, I have decided that it's time for our hubbubs.
Great.
Because we've got just a couple minutes left to go. And Peter, let's start with you. What's your hubbub for today?
Well, some people may know that the Phoenix publishes a newspaper also in Portland, Maine. And so I'm Dateline Portland bringing you a breaking story of one Robert Smith, age 32, who over the last year has been summoned, arrested, and taken to court for loudly whistling. It has been a real cause up there.
Is he whistling lewdly or is
loudly?
I've heard him whistle, and he doesn't whistle badly, but neither does he whistle beautifully. But he's got the Portland Chamber of Commerce and the Portland Downtown District all up in arms. They're very concerned about unruly behavior. And it just so happens that Portland has an ordinance on the book that loud whistling equals disorderly behavior. But there has been a judicial compromise. He has agreed not to whistle while stationary, and so now instead he walks all around downtown whistling at will. A breaking part of this story is that my sources tell me that Starbucks may well be the big villain here, that they're the merchants most concerned. But
please tell me they're also concerned, say, regarding those really loud Harley Davidsons, which I'm sure, you know, are breaking decibel levels higher than any man could whistle?
They're not concerned about the back-to-Jesus fundamentalist preachers who populate downtown Providence. They're not concerned about a lot of things. But for some reason, Robert Smith, whistler, has put himself in the eye of the authorities in Portland.
Oh, dear. Renee Love, you're a hubbub.
Well, in the small is beautiful department, a full-size scale model of the 300-square-foot micro unit that Mayor Menino wants to build to attract the innovation nerds to the waterfront district is on display at the downstairs from the Boston Society of Architects headquarters on Congress Street.
Have you been
in
it?
You bet. And, you know, it's fascinating to imagine living in there. You know, it's there's barely enough room for you and your iPad, you know. But it is the future, and you know, so I recommend that people check it out.
300 square feet, only a little bit smaller than my place right now. But so, are the is the bed and like what is there like
it's kind of a modular unit. There's a full size bed and sort of a kitchen, bathroom, and not very much of a sitting area. What's interesting to me about this is that these micro units are, you know, aimed at young people primarily. These young people are redefining the definition of private space and public space. You know, they want their private bedroom and bathroom, but as far as they're concerned, the city is their living room. You know, the local bistro is their kitchen. You know, they don't need to have their own private kitchen, private living room, private, you know, dining space. Mm-hmm. They're willing to make the entire city their home.
It's really a cool concept, and we'll see how popular they are once they're available.
Well,
for
and
people
also
to
how it. Affordable. That's a big question yet.
The big question, maybe.
Yeah.
Well, my hubbub has to do with cooking because this week a local chef, Kristen Kish, has won a major honor in terms of a television honor, I guess. She's taken the Top Chef top honor this week, and Kish is the chef de cuisine at Stir, one of Barbara Lynch's restaurant. And she says it really hasn't sunk in 100% yet, but I hope that the fact that now she's nationally famous, she still decides to stay in Boston because great chefs are becoming very much a fabric of this place, and I hope she stays. So congratulations to Kristen Kish. On that point, I'm going to say these two great talents, I hope you stay in Boston as well. Renee Loth.
Thank you.
Editor of Architecture Boston and columnist for The Globe. Thanks so much, Renee.
Thank you. It was fun.
And Peter Kadzis, editor of The Phoenix. Great to have you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up next, we'll talk to the real-life inspiration of the behind the movie The Sessions. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.